We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
I stand on the edge of my street with a knife out in my back. Not an enemy to secretly creep to.
Welcome to Irreplaceable Truths. I'm Dr. G, and I'm here with a very special guest today. If you do not know this man, I recommend you hit pause and you find out who he is. I'm here with Dr. Peter Weinstein. He's one of the greatest veterinary advocates I've known in my entire career, starting freshman year in vet school. His accolades are huge, so I'll keep it very mild, and then I'll let him go into some of his fun things that he's done. He's a Cornell grad. He's went to the University of ILL.
INI.
That's where I met him my freshman year. He was the executive director of the SCVMA. He was the person who I replaced at the job that I finally took over and bought the practice. He does Vets for Pets, which is a phenomenal organization in Orange County, which basically was started trying to put a bunch of very successful practices together, right? Have good minds meet.
Absolutely. Just collegiality and collaboration.
And now you're teaching at Western University. You're speaking all over the world. You're writing books left and right. You have a great passion for helping the underserved. I didn't get why you left the profession. Until 2021, there was an article that came out that talked about veterinary economics and burnout. And it made me realize why you do what you do. You're the one who inspired me to get my MBA. And then Pepperdine's the one who kept me on for my doctorate. So first off, I just want to say thank you for everything you've done for the profession. And I also want to say thank you for having me on your podcast, but I'm not going to be as reserved today, probably. I don't have to be as filtered. So I guess the first question I have is what made you leave the profession, or not leave the profession, leave the clinics?
Well, first off, let me thank you for the introduction. I'm glad there was some Kleenex next to me so I could dab my eyes, because you were way too generous in recognizing some of the things that I've done and continue to do. And really, my focus is just to keep the profession positive, bring fun back into it, and make the profession better for the next generation, because as you know, I have an investment in the next generation since my daughter graduated from veterinary school just over a year ago. So I left clinical practice. Well, if I go back to opening my own hospital, and by the way, one of the things we can talk about is my feelings about entrepreneurship and independent veterinary hospitals and the need to keep veterinary medicine independent. But I opened my own hospital after my entrepreneurial seizure about 3 years out of school. And as you know, most of us who are my generation and older got very little business education, and I made all the mistakes that were possible. I had a great business partner who was very patient and tolerant of me. You worked for him, so you know that. And then I went back to school and got my MBA while I was running my hospital, and I realized there was a big, bad world out there that we could be better in from the profession standpoint. So I made a lot of changes within my practice, made it more successful, put systems and processes in place, started to have more fun, and then realized I wanted to have a bigger impact on the veterinary profession. And so I got involved with organized veterinary medicine at the Southern California Veterinary Medical Association level, locally in South Orange County, and then within the regional association, and then eventually within the state association. But it was during that time that I realized there was more to being a veterinarian than just living in our Dilbert-like cubicles known as a veterinary hospital. So as the hospital grew and got bigger, and as the opportunities for selling the hospital increased, because that was the time that VCA, and at that point in time, NVA, were seeking veterinary practices, I said, you know, Peter, there's no time like the present to try to make a difference. So my MBA thesis was, does the veterinary profession need better practice management software and or better or more veterinary practice consultants? Both of which, the answer was yes. So I said, great opportunity. And when the time came, I was able to sell my practice, not for as much as you did, but I was able to sell my practice and continue to do things that helped make the profession bigger. I wanted to have a bigger outreach than I could have in my practice. And I was very limited in what I could do there, but I found myself with more options after I had the freedom to become involved with different things. And as you know, I've been recalibrating myself multiple different times, and I'm failing retirement.
I'm failing retirement as well. But the thing is, I think I have the same belief as you, is that the career that we chose, the profession that we chose, is absolutely amazing. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen from when you graduated to now?
Electricity.
Okay. Cars.
Yes.
Rotary phones to dial, touch dial.
I think when I was in veterinary school, veterinary medicine was still very much a passion that generated income for the veterinarians who were in it from a career standpoint. Now, my class at the University of Illinois was 50-50 in terms of gender makeup. And so we were at the tipping point when the profession was moving from a very male-dominated profession to a currently more female-dominated profession. So one of the biggest changes in the last 38 years is the percentage of women in the profession from that standpoint. I think the next biggest change was the impact of external variables that have changed the delivery of veterinary medicine, as we have seen the investment of private equity, venture capital, et cetera, into practices, and how that has changed some of the dynamics within the profession.
We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste. Cereal. Coffee. Dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
We have also seen a different focus on education in terms of increasing number of veterinary schools. The technology that we have access to as veterinarians has. I remember at U of I them wheeling the ultrasound in, and only one person was allowed to touch the ultrasound. It probably was six figures back then, and it probably weighed 80 pounds. But I think it took two people to wheel the ultrasound into the room to do a cardiac ultrasound. And let's just say the resolution was something like, you know, when the TV stations go off and all you see is the pixelation. So technology in terms of what we can do with computers, and I could go on. There has so much has changed in the last 38 years, but the one thing that has not changed and better never change is the importance of the patient and the client to the veterinarian in terms of providing optimized patient care and client experience.
So when you talk about clients, because, I mean, no one, I don't think, has a better pulse of what's going on in the profession than you. Is it a general assumption that clients have become more, I don't want to say demanding, I want to say they expect more. And that really takes its toll on veterinarians. What kind of feedback have you been getting about the client interactions around the country?
Well, I think the pandemic seemed to have changed some of the veterinary client relationship in terms of stress. And it's only gotten a little bit worse post pandemic. But I think client expectations go back further because the human-animal bond and the importance of pets to people has been increasingly studied, and we are much more knowledgeable and aware of the human-animal bond now than we ever have been. And so as pets have moved from the outhouse to in the house, from the laundry room to the bedroom to the bed, we have seen a stronger and stronger bond between pets and people. And I'm not sure we have fully recognized that as a profession and promoted how important the veterinary profession is to maintaining and retaining the human-animal bond and how important pets are to people from that standpoint. But what has happened to a degree is expectations for clients have escalated because they've seen levels of care go up dramatically. They've also seen the cost of care go up dramatically. But in my opinion, what we as a profession haven't recognized is that we are not a healthcare provider. And this is whether it's equine, food animal, companion animal, anything that you're dealing with a client and a patient. We are a service industry that provides healthcare. And so now we have to learn how to deliver service. And I'm not sure we have done so. So I think some of the client pushback that we're getting is from the fact that the service levels that they're expecting for the price that they are paying has a disconnect. And so I think it's going to be more and more important that we as a profession start to ensure that the people who we hire are prepared to provide that level of service, understand that the clients are who pays their salaries. And we also have to recognize the psychology of the patient and the client that we're seeing. So there's all of these different variables. Do I think clients have become more difficult? Yes, but not just in veterinary medicine. I saw a woman try to climb across the counter at the American Airlines desk in Dallas only to get arrested. And I've seen it at the front desk at hotels with people checking in. I think the human race has become less tolerant. And I think there are so many stressors going on, and I don't want to comment on the rest of the world, but so many stressors going on in the United States right now that I think everybody is on edge. And so the veterinary profession, because we take care of fur people, has to deal with it. And we're not really that well prepared for it as professionals because we're doctors focused on patient care. And we don't always hire and definitely do not take the time to train our client service people about what it is in terms of emotional intelligence that we need to have to deal with the emotions that clients have with respect to their pets and their wallets.
Well, you know, and you basically hit on what three of the four things I'm studying for my dissertation. And just to make it clear, when you talk about a service industry, we are considered the same when it comes to the people working at an airline, on the plane, at a call center, at a restaurant. That's the type of service people are expecting. And it's such a double standard because I don't know if the human medicine world is experiencing that. Now, granted, I would love to see a study on the concierge type doctors that are going more into the service industry. And that's kind of what veterinarians are. We're kind of like concierge type things. I bet it's more for the house call veterinarian than it is the ones who come to the office. But I don't believe that many who go into this profession realize how important service is and how important emotional control is. And when you talk about emotional intelligence, it's not only knowing, reading the owner's emotions, it's reading your own emotions, and it's reading, you know, the room, it's reading, you know, what are you saying? Is it coming across clearly? And unfortunately, you know, you said, I still don't think business is taught well at most schools. I'm not going to say Western because I know who's in charge of that. But I would say at most schools, business isn't taught. And I would say in a great majority of the schools, emotional intelligence isn't taught. And a lot of people used to think emotional intelligence was a trait, but it's an ability and you can train it. And I think whoever's listening, especially if they're early in their career or not started their career yet, I think learning and reading emotional intelligence books and learning how to control your emotions will help you immensely long term. Now, the one thing you brought up was a human-animal bond. And I don't know if you ever experienced it, but I think veterinarians started realizing how big the human-animal bond was and was starting to take advantage of it. Do you think that's still around today? I keep looking at, and the reason why I asked that, I keep looking at why private equity venture capital came in. I think they saw that we were very dispersed. They could come in, they could control everything, they could control the costs.
Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings. Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paint when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details. Save big money at
Menards. They could take over everything. But the one thing they didn't realize is that veterinary hospitals are not run by an Excel spreadsheet. Do you think 10 years from now, we're still going to be talking about private equity and venture capital trying to get into the market?
I think we'll still be talking about private equity and venture capital in the market. I think we'll be talking about it differently. I think that there was a bright, shiny object that, especially during the pandemic, looked great because of the growth in revenue that occurred in that two-year window starting in like June of 2020. But I think that the complexity of running a veterinary hospital could never be envisioned by somebody from outside of a veterinary hospital. I think looking from the outside in, if you strictly look at a profit and loss statement or a balance sheet, it's like, golden calf. Let's pray to the golden calf of veterinary medicine. Only to find out that there's a heck of a lot of work that goes into running a veterinary hospital. It's very people dependent, which makes it very unpredictable. Most practices do not have systems in place, and they're basically reinventing themselves every day. And most veterinary hospitals became successful, as did you, as did I, because of the building of relationships with our clients, with their patients, and with their team. And it is very hard to see that from the outside unless you become embedded within it. And the emotions that go through a practice every day, when you have euthanasias, when you have sick, chronically ill patients, when you have emotionally distraught clients, is not reflected on a profit and loss. So I do think that there will be some outside money that continues to be involved with the profession as they learn how to manage a profession that's built on relationships, not on transactions. The relationships drive the transactions, but you can't focus on a bottom line without potentially compromising relationships. And I think that's part of what we're seeing now with the data that shows revenue up at basically a cost of living, but transactions continuing to drop. I think we're starting to see pushback, and most practices feel like it's 2019 again, from a business standpoint. And I think the profitability that was present 2 years ago with the escalating costs of goods, with the escalating cost of people, both professional and paraprofessional, doctors and staff, have made some of the veterinary hospitals much harder to manage from a private equity venture capital standpoint. And I think there's going to be some interesting activity over the next couple of years as the 60, 70 consolidators consolidate themselves. It'll be the Pac-Man world of big eating little. And eventually, I think it'll stabilize to 10, 8 to 12 or so venture capital private equity companies who've got it figured out. But I think there'll be some new business models, companies like Modern Animal that do some startups, and some of the concierge practices that are developing that have figured out relationships or memberships are probably more important than seeing more and charging more.
So what do you tell your students when if they have concerns about the cost of care and how they communicate that to a client?
I think I tell them that I apologize. I apologize as somebody who's been a leader of the profession in some way, shape, or form for a long time, that we as a profession have not done enough to self-promote. You've been on enough airplanes and been with enough people who are pet owners that are not your clients, and they start to talk about veterinary care. They may not know you're a veterinarian. And they start to say, you know, how expensive it is. And it's like, and then they start to say, well, I didn't even know that dogs got cancer and cats get diabetes and we can do total hip replacements. Most pet owners really don't understand all of the things that veterinarians do and all of the stress and the moving parts that go into running a veterinary hospital. So I apologize for not setting up the next generation to succeed by self-promoting the veterinary profession. We really have not done a good job cheerleading all of the great things that we do, all of the great things that we can do. And so as a result, we tend to be very defensive in the way we approach things. We apologize when we present an invoice. We don't talk about the fact that, you know, to be able to have this facility comes with an inordinate number of costs, both people and equipment and supplies. When you, Dr. G, retired, go to a doctor, you can't get a blood sample drawn there. You can't get imaging done there. You can't spend the night there. You can't get a bath and a haircut. Well, you don't need a haircut.
Here we go again.
And, you know, but a veterinary hospital is also a pharmacy. It's also a food store. And so think about all of those moving parts, and most consumers don't know that, don't understand it. And so when it comes down to the cost of veterinary care, I explain to the students that you have to recognize that if you were a receptionist or even a technician in a veterinary hospital and you saw an invoice for $1,000 come through the door, it doesn't all go into the owner's pocket. In fact, a very small portion of it actually goes to the owner as a profit or return on investment. The owner gets paid to be a doctor, which I think is very appropriate, and the staff gets paid to do the work that they do. But most people think that every dollar that comes through the door is profit. But it's far from it. It is a very expensive, very inefficient, very ineffective, very low productive business that we've got to figure out how to improve at that level as well. So what do I tell my students? Be a good doctor. Don't be defensive. Understand the value of the services that you provide, and make sure your communication skills are at the top level, because that's how you build relationships. It's about the communication skills.
Well, communication is also, you know, the save your ass part of veterinary medicine.
Absolutely.
Being honest, it was funny because when I graduated vet school, they told me to never admit or say there was a problem, because that automatically made you guilty. Is that still taught today?
So if the question is, do you tell the truth to a client when something goes wrong? First phone call goes to your insurance company. Second phone call goes to your attorney. The third phone call goes to the client after the insurance company and the attorney tell you how to couch what to say. I think we have a responsibility to ourselves to be able to sleep at night. And so, yes, the times that we had bad outcomes when I was in practice, we told the truth. And most clients appreciate the truth. Most clients don't appreciate a dance. And so when it comes down to it, you'll hear attorneys say, don't give clients any information that can be held against you in the court of law. Most insurance companies say, tell you, do what the attorney has to say. My answer is, and everything I've read when it comes down to compassion and empathy, is the truth will win.
Again, compassion and empathy,
mm-hmm.
part of that emotional intelligence equation you're talking about.
Absolutely.
The soft skills of veterinary medicine. Do you, in your personal opinion, are they taught enough in their education?
The soft skills of veterinary medicine. No. I think there is so much to learn on the left brain side of things, the clinical side, physiology, anatomy, microbiology, pathology, every freaking ology under the sun, including psychology, that we don't have time, and we don't always look to create time in the curriculum for the postgraduate skills that will make a veterinarian successful. I think a successful veterinarian has an equal balance of clinical knowledge and expertise and people skills, communication skills, written, verbal, social skills, and the ability to handle and hold a conversation that doesn't stress them out. There are veterinarians who would rather be doing open heart surgery than have a conversation. And there are veterinarians like myself who could spend all day in an exam room, but don't let me go into a surgery suite. So in answer to your question, I think that there is not sufficient balance, but I also know that it's very difficult with the curriculum at most of the schools to find a place for it and to find a faculty who can teach it, because unfortunately, a lot of the really great faculty are those who are out in clinical practice, because that's where reality is. And we live in a primary care world, but for the most part in veterinary school, we're taught at a tertiary care level.
So if these students aren't being taught the soft skills, and you said the best teachers are out in practice, how do you explain to students this is what you should look for in your first clinic?
I explain, and we've had a couple of people come in from outside the profession as well as within the profession who talk about basically being a diagnostician of the hospital you're hoping to go and work at. So kicking the tires, talking to the staff, seeing the client experience. I don't think that you can, and I made a huge mistake in my first job, so I lasted it at 3 months in terms of choosing the wrong practice. I think you have to do your due diligence. I think that there are a lot of offers that are huge amounts of money on the table for current veterinary students, and they may be a mistake. I think you have to learn the culture of the practice. and I can't remember who it was. It may have been Robin Brogdon. It may have been Dan Markwalder, who at one of the lectures recently said, ask the staff at a hospital that you're interested in working at. And I would suggest this if you have technicians who might be listening to this or client service or anybody who might be going into the profession, not just the doctors. Ask the staff, tell me about the culture of your practice. And then when you interview with the manager, hey, can you tell me about the culture of your practice? And then if you interview with the doctor or owner, tell me about the culture of your practice. And if they can't, if they stammer around it, or if it's not clearly defined, I would be significantly concerned about what it's going to be like if you have a practice that has no vision, no mission, no values, and no culture.
Well, and then another thing is you can add into that, what if you have three different answers?
That means you have none. Right. If they're not consistent, they're all singing different songs, which is not music, but cacophony.
That means there's no communication within the practice.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm very proud of the practice I had. It was very family oriented. Obviously, I took it over from a phenomenal man, Dr. John Hamill, and he always put the staff first. He always put himself second, which I took to heart, but I was also very blessed because where I worked in undergrad for 5 years, it was the same way. And I made sure I brought it along like that. You know, and it's very important, you know, and you talk about these high paying jobs that are being offered. A lot of these students don't realize that salary, and more importantly, that signing bonus, quote unquote, if you leave, you got to pay most of that back. And if you don't hit numbers, you're going to lose it after your first year. And the worst part, and maybe you know better than me, are how many of these early career vets coming out of school are put into practices where there's either one doctor that they work with or no other doctors that they work with?
Well, I don't know the percentage of how many new grads go into single doctor as the second doctor or go to a multi-hospital owned facility and then are put out on their own, except to say that statistically, the average veterinary hospital is 2.2 doctors in this country, some of the 30,000 or so veterinary hospitals. That means half of the hospitals that are out there that might be looking are one or two doctors, which means at some point in time, in all likelihood, you're going to be by yourself in that first 6 months out of school, which is scary as all get out. I remember my first job, the first day I got my license, I was given the pager. I was put on the schedule, I was on call, and I had 6 exam rooms to work with no other doctors. And when I had an emergency, hit by car Airedale, never forget it, cardiac contusions and a dislocated elbow. And I had a receptionist to help me after hours. So let's just say that when I talk to students and I talk to Brooke, I never suggest that they will be alone for the first 6 months. They really need to have a resource with them. I also tell them that they will not be productive for the first 6 months. I think it will take most veterinary students to ramp up to meeting the target to meet their salary 6 months. In a practice with good mentoring, and to me, mentoring is not just the mental health side of it, but as the technical side of it. When you focus on the head, the heart, and the hands of mentoring, then you can be more successful. But the technical skills and the communication skills need to go hand in hand to eventually be a productive veterinarian. I think most students leave school very good.
Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.
Good at the diagnostic side of things, okay on the surgical side of things, and scared to death of the communication side of things. And unfortunately, especially in small animal clinical practice, which is where the vast majority of our students go, they're, in many cases, and I use a picture of this, and you were a swimmer, I used a picture of this in one of my slides, where I basically have a picture of somebody getting thrown into the deep end of the pool and saying swim with concrete bricks on their legs, because that's how I think it feels. And of course, as they get closer to the edge keeps moving.
Yeah, some of the scariest things I've seen right now are veterinarians are going into relief work.
Mm-hmm.
6 months out of school, a year out of school. And I talked to my wife, who's an amazing veterinarian as well. And even though she grew up in a veterinary clinic because her dad was a veterinarian, it still took her about 2 years to be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how these veterinarians, these early career veterinarians, are going into relief work. And they're the ones who are saying, oh, you know, I get work-life balance, which I understand. But do you really get the beautiful depthness of what this profession can bring you, you know?
Well, I think relief work is an option that many recent grads have taken because of a bad first work experience. I think I was just going to use a bad metaphor, but I won't. But I do think if you leave a bad work experience, you think that's how all work experiences are. And so you don't want to throw yourself back into another hospital. You would feel much more comfortable going out to different restaurants and trying different meals before you figure out which restaurant you want to work in. So I don't think it's not a great idea for a new or recent graduate, because you don't have the mentoring there and the case management skills in many cases. But I do think it's a peace of mind situation. And currently with relief doctors making what they're making, and I don't deny that they are making an appropriate amount, you can work a third of the time and make the same amount of money you are making working full time. So we've got all of these different variables, which is part of what veterinary medicine in 2024 or 2025, whenever this is published, is going to look like. There are so many external variables as well as internal variables that are impacting the veterinary profession that we can't wrap our arms around them. And I think that's only adds to the uncertainty, Maslow's hierarchy. You know, we need certainty. I think that's what's contributing tremendously to the uncertainty of the veterinary profession, whether it's a single doctor practice or a 40-doctor conglomerate. I think there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty that all of us are feeling who have a finger on the pulse of the veterinary profession.
Well, and I also want to make clear, is just because you go to a 9 or 10-doctor practice doesn't mean you're going to have 9 or 10 doctors that want to mentor you. You know, some of the greatest mentoring practice stories I ever hear of is when you go to a single doctor practice who's so relieved to finally have somebody there, they will do everything in their power to make sure that you're trained, that you learn, because they want you to stay. I mean, after you left, Dr. Hamill had the hardest time finding somebody, and he was the president of the California Veterinary Medical Association, and he didn't have anyone there. So when he come back, even though you might have been gone for 2 days, it was like he was gone for 10. And so it's hard, because clients are very, and that's the other thing that I think people have to understand. Just because a client doesn't want to see you doesn't mean they don't like you, doesn't mean they don't trust you. It's just that they have a relationship with Dr. X. And they will come see you eventually, and then that's when you have to work your magic. You got to learn to play the game, and it'll actually work out well. So now I know at the beginning you mentioned entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
The most rewarding thing I ever did was own a veterinary practice. It was so rewarding, I got a second one, right? Loved it, because you get to control the culture. You get to control the costs. You get to control everything. Are a lot of veterinarians coming out now wanting to own practices again?
So I do a survey of the veterinary students at the beginning of their third year before we start the business class. And I said, how many of you are interested or thinking about business ownership? How many of you want to do post-veterinary school education? And how many of you are sitting on the fence somewhere? And there's a couple of other choices. About a third of the veterinary students, I think it was 37%, are interested in owning a business at some point in time, including board-certified people. About a third will go into post-secondary education, whether that's internship, public health, residency, et cetera. And then there's a third who have other ideas, whether it's zoo medicine or whatever the case may be. So I think that my goal in class is to convince them that entrepreneurship is the solution to life control, debt control, and a lifestyle that would allow them to enjoy things at a level that they would not have been able to do as a associate. When you are an associate, you work at the beck and call of somebody or something else. When you are the owner, you are the one who sets the tone. You're the leader. And so it's not easy. It's a heck of a lot of work. It has a tremendous amount of responsibility because in your case, and in my case, we were the father of staffs of 15, 20, 30 people. But ultimately, when you build that successful business, you will have the benefit of making a team of successful, potentially future veterinarians, future technicians, future managers, and you control your own balance. You control your own income. So all that being said, I think we're seeing more of a lean towards entrepreneurship. I think some of the questions we have to address are whether to do a startup, which having done that, there was a lot of top ramen for the first 2 years, or by an existing practice, and then dealing with, well, practices are so expensive, and what about the competition from national corporations, and the banks won't loan me money, and there's a lot of, for lack of a term, fake news out there when it comes to entrepreneurship that I want to dispel, because I think entrepreneurship, as you noted, is so rewarding, not just short-term, but long-term in terms of what it gives you as you build equity and you build a legacy for yourself. And I think many of us who have been entrepreneurs look back at the legacy that we created. And in your case and in my case, well, maybe they didn't end up quite as well as we would have liked. But when we were there, we built a legacy. And it's much harder to do that as an associate.
So I'm glad you used the word legacy, because I think the biggest issue and the uncertainty that this profession's facing is that a lot of the legacies, i.e. retiring veterinarians, they just disappear, right? And that's kind of how I feel, a little part of me, that venture capital or private equity was able to come in so easily. Because a lot of these people did not stand up and say, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, this is what it's going to do to the profession. This is how it's going to be. And especially now that, you know, venture capital is here, whatever, I'm not even going to mess with it. I think they're going to shoot themselves in the foot. But where are all these legacies? Where are these cheerleaders? Where are the fans of this profession that's given so much to us?
Well, one of them is sitting right here, and the other one is sitting across from me. But I want to challenge anybody who listens to this that anybody who got a nice retirement check, quote unquote, from a large company is the next generation of faculty members at universities. I think that the best teachers are those who did. Some of the best faculty I had at University of Illinois were those who had been in private practice and came back to teach surgery or teach internal medicine or whatnot, or teach business. I think that there's a responsibility of the sellers from the last, I mean, we made 300 multimillionaires over the last 5 years. I think if every one of those sellers went back to the university from which they graduated and started to contribute to the business class and taught about how they became a successful entrepreneur, write books, write articles. I would love to see a veterinary college that was staffed solely by people who had actually been in private practice. I can dream. But I think it's important for the people who sold to celebrate how they got there, to teach us how to become successful as they did, and not just to play golf and sit out on a sailboat somewhere. So I think there's a responsibility from that standpoint to help provide leadership and direction. And I think we need some young leadership coming out of the veterinary schools, but I think we also need some legacy leadership to help us understand. And a lot of people saw the dollar signs and they didn't see the writing on the wall. I don't think, and I sold to a corporation, so I have nothing to say but positive things from a corporate standpoint. I just don't think we knew what the unintended consequences could be, because in many cases we were blinded by an opportunity and a large check, and in many cases, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, burnout due to the stressors that the pandemic brought. I think we're going to start to see some normalization. I think I know that the multipliers that were being offered by the private equity venture capital groups during the pandemic have been halved. I think the expectations from the seller standpoint have changed in terms of not being able to get 100% cash, and a 3-year commitment is a strong expectation. So I think there's going to be some changes. And by the way, if you are looking to be an entrepreneur, you don't have to be a doctor. You just need to partner with one. You can be a manager. You can be a credentialed technician. You can be an assistant. But you can build a team of veterinarian, manager, technician, assistant, all who come together to build or buy a veterinary hospital, because the banks are very eager and very willing to finance the purchases of veterinary hospitals. And I think it's just going to take a little bit of, imaginary financing to be able to match some of the offers that will be on the table from private equity venture capital. But I think we can keep independent veterinary hospitals independent because the banks are willing to help us do so.
Yeah, I'm very excited to hear about that finally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was hard. I mean, it was hard to get, you know, a loan for the amount that even a private practice was even trying to sell for back in the day.
Right.
They're like, oh, no, this is too much. But it's good to hear that there's some more leeway there.
Yep.
When it comes to entrepreneurship, how much does student debt play into your ability to get a loan?
Absolutely none. Student debt has no impact. It's considered good debt because it was an investment in your career. Student debt does not have an impact because if you have no credit card debt, if you have some equity of your own, if you have some collateral, the risk of a veterinary hospital failing is less than 1%. So the banks recognize this. If you can start a hospital, make a fair and equitable salary as the owner, make sufficient amount of extra equity, also known as return on investment, to pay off the loans, by making the same amount as an owner as you were making as an associate, you have no problem paying off your debt. Now, as soon as that return on investment becomes yours, all of that money could be used to pay down debt. So there is no problem with respect to student debt. For those of you who are students that are listening, student debt doesn't work against you. It's all the other debt that you accumulated by buying a Beamer instead of a Kia that can get you into trouble. So don't worry about student debt. The banks take that into consideration. Just don't go bankrupt. Don't have a lot of credit card debt. Try to keep your credit score in the 600, 700, and if you can, 800 range, and the banks will be open to that. And then one other variable. If you're buying an existing hospital, that's when the due diligence comes in. Is there sufficient cash flow? Is there sufficient profitability for you to buy that hospital and make a salary and pay the staff and pay the bills and pay the loans? And that's where the banks will come in, or some appraisals will come in and say, this is what this practice is valued. And you don't want to pay more than a practice is valued, even though you think you can turn it around, because that's playing the lottery a little bit. That's thinking that you can actually go in and make something better. And that's a little bit dangerous. So the banks will tell you, and the practice evaluators will tell you, whether the value on that practice is something that you can get sufficient loan cash for to make it work.
So you read all these articles about, student debt's so high, they're so high, but yet you're sitting here saying it's okay. It drives me crazy in general in the public, especially in Southern California. They rent their apartment, they rent their house, yet they buy the Beamer, the Mercedes, the G-Wagon. It just doesn't make sense. Why do you buy things that depreciate in value the second you drive off the lot, you know? And that's a whole nother topic for a whole nother time.
Well, let me just weigh in on that quickly. And that is the fact that both of my kids in their senior year in undergrad, I introduced them to a financial planner. And I think that for those of you who are listening that are parents, get your kids hooked up with a financial planner. It could be yours. It could be somebody else. For those of you who are veterinary students, it's not too early to get a financial planner. And for those of you who are hospital owners, if you don't have a financial planner, what are you going to do with that large check that somebody's going to give you? Or are you going to have enough money to retire from selling your practice now when you still have 20, 25 years of life ahead of you? So in answer to your question, bad advice. Find somebody who will give you good advice and be in your face from that standpoint.
I make the argument that every veterinary student should meet a certified financial planner and a CPA.
Mm-hmm.
Because what are you going to do when if you do get that signing bonus? They don't realize that that's a huge lump sum that they get up front. And the federal government and most of the states, the state government, at least in California, it's 14%. They're going to take over 50% of it. It's gone.
Well, and then you've also got, you know, the understanding of how student debt works and the fact that if you try to go to debt forgiveness at 20 some odd years down the road, you still will owe interest and taxes on that as well because it's considered income. So there's all of these variables that require you to build a success team that includes attorneys, many of them, multiple attorneys, contract attorneys and malpractice attorneys, and to have an accountant, to have a financial planner. All of these people who are around you, and by the way, it's best if they're not part of your family. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, family and business just don't mix. They just don't mix. Friends and, usually friends and business don't mix either.
Right. So what are we doing here?
Well, we're not doing business together. We're just talking.
Yeah. But we are friends.
We are friends. You know, and the thing is, I really hope that veterinary schools do bring in more of these types of conversations compared to where we've been. Because I had Dr. Benson.
The anesthesiologist?
Anesthesiologist. One Saturday is the only business class we got. It was on contracts. And he's like, one of the good things to ask for is maybe they'll get you a membership to a gym. And I'm like, seriously? Because I knew how much went in, because my father was an economist, so I knew how much went into it. And I'm like, man, you're setting people up here to fail. You and I talk about that, by the way, a lot, about how we feel sometimes students are just being set up to fail. Is it getting better?
You know, I think it's interesting that many young veterinarians choose the field very young. I don't think a dentist chooses at 16, 12, 8 that they want to be a dentist. I don't think a financial planner at 8 plans to become a financial planner, even if their father was. My dad was a CPA. I think I knew pretty early on that I didn't want to become a CPA. My mom was a biology teacher. I knew pretty well on early on that I wasn't going to become a biology teacher. My grandfather was a general practitioner, MD, and that looked pretty cool because he lived upstairs and his doctor's office was downstairs and he made house calls, but I had to deal with people. So I think part of this profession is that we drink the Kool-Aid really young and we become part of the veterinary cult. And so we are willing to spend inordinate amounts of money to go to veterinary school. How many professions will an applicant apply 3, 4, 5 times to get in and do all sorts of extra education and work experience to try to get in than veterinary medicine? How many veterinary students don't have a plan B if they don't get in? So I think what we've got is we've got a captive profession with a very eager audience with astronomical numbers of students still applying to get into the veterinary schools that maybe have not pulled the curtain back and looked at the Wizard of Oz. And I'm not suggesting that there's an evil thing behind the curtain. I am suggesting that we really do need to help the next generation of veterinary students know and understand what veterinary medicine is in terms of the expectations from a clinical standpoint, from a business standpoint, from a communication standpoint, and from an emotional standpoint, and from a self-awareness standpoint. Can I handle 30 euthanasias in 30 days? Can I handle a client who goes on the internet and rails me on Yelp? Can I handle a client that comes in with a sick pet and has no money? I mean, there are so many emotional components to veterinary medicine. It's not just playing with puppies and kittens, and I'm not sure we do the best job fully vetting, for lack of a better term, that aspect of things.
It's funny because I talked to the one who came up with the concept of emotional labor in 83, and I said, you know, what do you think the problem is? And she's like, everyone goes in thinking, oh, I'm going to be able to work with dogs and cats and puppies and kittens and, you know, cows, horses, whatever. But then they graduate and they say, oh, shit, I have to be a doctor. And there's a lot that goes into it. And again, I just want people to realize that there are people like Peter A. Weinstein, who's, it's so ironic your initials are Paul. myself, my other guests, that we're here to help these students, help these early career veterinarians, help older career veterinarians with whatever they need. I mean, the biggest thing is to make sure they communicate their issues, discuss and be open about it. Don't keep it in. I hope they realize that they're not the only ones that probably have dealt with horrible situations. What was the craziest situation you can remember?
The craziest situation that I can remember. I mean, there were so many different business situations of things going on within my staff and people problems and everything else. And, you know, crazy clients who threatened you because the outcomes weren't there. I had a client who we did a euthanasia on their pet, and we sent it off to be cremated. And she wanted me to prove that those ashes were really her dog's. So I said, well, we can open the box and see if there's any long bones still in there. We have some radiographs of your dog, and we can hold the long bones against the radiographs and see if they match up. And that's what I did. And that was about, and I remember the client's name like it was yesterday. I won't use it on the podcast, but it was one of the most unique experiences that each and every one of us in this profession, all 110,000 veterinarians in the United States, have had some sort of crazy experience like that. You know, the phone call that comes and says, my dog just ate my stash, or the surgery done on the Labrador that ate pantyhose in a household where the wife doesn't wear pantyhose. You know, these types of things that occur. But I will never forget the holding up a femur against a radiograph to show that it was actually that client's dog.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
Wow. So what are you doing now? Obviously, you have
everything.
I know, but you're doing your courageous conversations.
Correct.
What is your premise behind those conversations?
So courageous conversations started in May of 2020, after or June of 2020, after the George Floyd murder, and it came from my reaching out to Dr. Phil Nelson, who at that point in time was the dean at Western University, and I said, Phil, we're going backwards. We're not going socially forward when we're having continued killings of black people. It feel like we're back in 1960. And he listened to me and he said, oh, we're going forward. It's just not as obvious to you. And so we started to have conversations on social issues, which of course were very interesting in the 2020 to 2024 timeframe, political issues, the veterinary profession, because he as a dean has different viewpoints on things, and I as a clinician in private practice, and all the different roles that I have. So courageous conversations, www.peterandphil.com, are our podcast just having unscripted conversations about world issues. And Some of them are political in nature, so you may or may not like what we have to say, but many of them are just encouraging people who are uncomfortable with their neighbor to have a conversation with them, with a friend to have a conversation with them, because it's those conversations that can help us deal with this chasm that has been created between people and this inability to have a conversation because somebody feels something about something else. I mean, there used to be a gap that was the size of a sidewalk crack. Now, excuse me, sorry. Now it's the size of the Grand Canyon. We need to have these conversations like you and I are having to start to bridge some of the gaps that have been created between people. We have to start to come together as a profession. We have to start to come together as a people so we can walk down the street and not worry about what people think about each other. We need to start to do a little bit more kumbaya and a little bit more hugging and a little bit less mugging.
Well, that all starts with the leadership.
Absolutely.
Whether it's the leadership of the country, leadership of the state, leadership of a practice, leadership of a university.
Right.
You know, leadership dictates what you get.
Absolutely. And as we kind of wrap up some thoughts, I would suggest that leadership is one of the weaknesses of the global veterinary profession, and that we need to start to teach leadership in the veterinary schools. We need to look to matriculate leaders into the veterinary curriculum, and we need to grow the next generation of leaders so that we have people who will take the veterinary profession to where it can go and to get it past the morass that we have been in. We need a next generation of leadership, and I really think that is one of the true weaknesses of the entire veterinary profession.
And that brings me back to the fact that all the legacies are gone out of the profession. All the ones who would be the greatest leaders are, and I don't know why.
Well, I don't know why they've left, but I do think that some of it is burnout. Some of it is just, you know, I've done it. Now I don't need to do any more. I'm not really sure. Maybe what you need to do is do a survey of those people who have left the profession in the last 10 years and find out what they're doing, what they're up to. Some of them have started other practices. Some of them have decided to start other careers, like doing podcasts called Irreplaceable Truths. And some of them are basically playing golf and out on a boat. I don't have an answer to the question, but I think it would be very interesting to figure out how we can reintroduce and integrate the legacy doctors, whether they're 40 years old or 80 years old, to send a message to the profession going forward about how great the profession is and how you guys can create your own destiny if you take a leadership role and you set the path and you have a vision, because leaders help set the vision. And I think that's part of where we need to be looking. What is the vision of the veterinary profession 1, 5, 10, 20 years down the road? Because we can't wait to 20 years down the road. It's too late then.
Yeah, and you also don't need leaders who say, hey, everything's okay. We've been doing it this way for 30 years. And make sure that the listeners understand, leaders are not born. Everyone could be a leader in their own way, in their own power. Everyone could be a leader. If you're a parent, you're a leader.
Hopefully.
Right.
Well, and I'll thank John Hamill, because I wasn't a leader until he coaxed me into leadership roles as well. So, John, this is all your fault. Otherwise, I'd just probably have been a very quiet associate for the last 38 years. But I saw what you did from a leadership standpoint and drank your Kool-Aid. And so I became part of that cult, and of course, probably have gotten some other people who look at me as a cult leader from that standpoint. So I think leadership is the way to help redirect the boat known as veterinary profession.
And in closing, I'm going to use a quote you told me. You told me this while I was at U of I. You came in and you lectured. And I think the quote you said was, 3% of your clients are going to make you hate your job. And so I close with that, because I want everyone to realize that 3% cannot allow you to lose the 97% who will support you, who will be there, who will come in and bring you food at Thanksgiving, gifts at Christmas, care about your family. So, again, this is Dr. G. I'm with Peter A. Weinstein, PAW. I didn't give a shout out to Vet Partners, who's another amazing organization who basically bring in the external supporters of veterinary medicine. Another great meeting, if anyone ever can make it, just to hear what people outside of the profession are doing to help support our profession. If you have any questions, you can always email me at drg@vetmedit. Dr. Weinstein, do you have an email that they could reach out to you at?
The best email is paw@simplesolutions4vets.com. paw@simplesolutions4vets.com.
Wonderful. Peter, thank you for coming. I'm going to have you on again. There's so much we need to probably discuss. And thank you again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
I stand on the edge of my street with a knife out in my back. Not an enemy to secretly creep to position that the